Awesome. So, everyone, I'd like to introduce Rachel Weisberg. She's an attorney at law who specializes in employment rights law. And she is here. She came all the way from Chicago, Illinois. Isn't that amazing? And so, she's here to give us a bit of a legal update and to answer any questions you may have. So, Rachel, the floor is yours.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. And hi to everybody. I wish that this was an in-person conference so that I'd be able to come to California instead of, chatting out of my basement in Chicago. But alas, this is our life these days. But I'm really, really happy to be here with all of you. As Sarah mentioned, I am a lawyer. I work at Equip for Equality. If you have not heard of Equip for Equality, we are the protection and advocacy agency for the state of Illinois. So we're essentially the Disability Rights California of Illinois. So most of what I do is represent people with disabilities in ADA cases. I do a lot of employment rights work, in addition to other types of disability advocacy. And in addition to my direct work as a lawyer, I do a lot of talking about the ADA, writing about the ADA, training about the ADA, which is, I think, how I got connected with you all, which I'm really happy to have done. I'm a kind of a self-proclaimed ADA nerd in that I just like to spend my days reading ADA updates and hearing about ADA cases, and so I try to stay as up on the ADA law as I can. So that's a bit of my background. Sarah mentioned I was asked today to speak about, just kind of give an ADA update about what's been happening, particularly for folks in the blind and low vision community, with a little bit of a focus on employment. And so my plan is to start by talking about ADA and websites. I'm sure this is something that's near and dear to a lot of your hearts and that you have all been part of bringing a lot of these cases. But there's been a big case in the last month on ADA and websites, so I wanted to spend a little time on that. I'll also then talk a little bit about the ADA and employment cases, and then, time permitting, just do a few other highlights of, I think, really interesting cases that have been brought by blind and low vision plaintiffs over the past year. And then, of course, happy to answer any questions. Feel free to interrupt me as I go if you have questions. Otherwise, I'm just gonna kind of keep chatting. So with that, why don't I start with a little discussion on the ADA and websites? And again, I'm sure that most of you know a lot of this, but just for some level setting, as a little bit of background, there's of course many different laws that apply when we look at how the ADA applies to websites. We're looking at the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and then within the ADA itself, there's different sections, right? So there's different titles of the ADA. We've got Title I, which is all about employment, and then we've got Title II, which is state and local governments, and then Title III, which is places of public accommodation. We also have the Rehabilitation Act, and then within the Rehabilitation Act, we also have sections. We have Section 504, which applies to any entity that receives federal financial assistance. And then we also have 508, right, which applies to federal agencies. So in all of these laws, we've got some really broad anti-discrimination requirements that are used in a lot of ways to say, hey, websites need to be accessible. And then within these different sections, there's some individual specific reasons that we as well need websites to be accessible. So most of the cases that have been brought about website accessibility have been brought under Title III of the ADA. And that, of course, is the part that applies to public accommodations or private businesses. And within the ADA, there's a requirement, again, sure that most folks are familiar with it, that agencies and entities need to provide auxiliary aids and services that are necessary to ensure effective communication. So we, colloquially call this the effective communication requirement. So when we look at these cases and we look at, folks who are bringing cases saying, hey, this website is not accessible to me as a blind user who uses a screen reading software, this is a violation of the ADA. Most of the time, the first question before the court is, okay, well, is this website even covered by Title III of the ADA? Is this website itself a place of public accommodation, or is it sufficiently tied to a place of public accommodation that it's required to be accessible? And then another thing that the court sometimes ask is, okay, let's say the website is covered by Title III. What does that mean? What does it mean to be quote unquote accessible? So you may remember that under the ADA, you know, Title III, in its definition of places of public accommodation, the way that the law defines place of public accommodation is by listing 12 different categories. And when you read these categories, there's no mention of websites and there's no mention of the internet. Well, is that a surprise to any of us? No, right? Because the ADA was passed in 1990, well before websites or the internet or any of that really existed as it does today. So, you know, because of that, courts have been a little bit all over the place when trying to figure out how does the ADA apply to Title, how does Title III of the ADA apply to websites? I think it's really important that throughout the discussion to remember that regardless of what the courts say, we also have the U.S. Department of Justice. The DOJ, of course, is the federal agency that enforces Title III of the ADA, and DOJ has consistently, over 20 years, and the first time they said this was in 1996, said, of course, Title III of the ADA applies to websites. They made this position, again, back in 1996, 25 years ago. They've articulated it over and over again. They've entered into numerous settlement agreements, many legal briefs. They wrote a letter to Congress in 2018, emphasizing again, yes, of course, Title III of the ADA applies to websites. And so it's really important that we remember we have the DOJ on our side, even though we don't have specific regulations yet about what website accessibility means. Okay, so what are the current legal theories? What do the courts say about websites and the ADA? Well, the most common and pervasive legal theories, there's essentially two. Well, now there's three, but there were two. So theory number one is what I would call the broadest theory, and that is that a website or a business that is housed entirely online can be a place of public accommodation, even if it has no physical structure, so long as it's providing services that otherwise fall within this definition of public accommodation. This is the legal theory that we get out of some of the circuits on the East Coast, the First and Second Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit, which is the circuit in Chicago, which is where I am. And so that's where we have, there's been cases, for instance, brought against Netflix. Netflix, of course, has no physical structure, right? It's something that's housed entirely online. But based on this theory that, of course, website is providing a service, just like if we went to a movie theater, website is providing an entertainment service. And so it doesn't matter that it's housed entirely online. We want to make sure that that service is accessible. So that, I would say, is our best theory. It's our theory out again in some of the East Coast and the Midwest. We also have a theory that's called the nexus theory. And this is something that, again, I'm sure most of you have heard of because this is the applicable theory for where you all are in California. And that's this theory that a website can be a place of public accommodation and can be covered by Title III of the ADA so long as there's some nexus or there's some connection between the website and a physical place of public accommodation. You know, this is a kind of, a common example would be, let's say you have a website that has like a location finder. And so, you know, we would go on the website to find where this physical store is. Well, that's a nexus between this website and a physical place of public accommodation. So that would be enough to make the website have to be accessible. And that's the theory that we have in the Ninth Circuit and a couple of the circuits as well. And that was the theory that we thought was the case in the 11th Circuit, which is for covers Alabama, Florida, and Georgia. And folks may remember that in 2017, there was a lawsuit filed on behalf of Juan Carlos Gill, who is an individual who's blind and used screen reading software, and he filed a lawsuit against the Winn-Dixie grocery store. Now, when he filed this lawsuit saying, hey, Winn-Dixie, your grocery store website is not accessible, guess what Winn-Dixie said? They didn't challenge that. They didn't say, no, you're wrong. It is accessible. They admitted, you're right. Our website is not accessible, but it doesn't matter because our website is not covered by Title III of the ADA. Well, this case went to a, it actually went to went to a judge. This was the first case in the entire country that was a website accessibility case that was decided by a judge. And the judge found for Mr. Gill and said Winn-Dixie's website violated Title III of the ADA. And they said, you know, we don't have to decide if the website itself is a place of public accommodation because there's enough connection, you know, they kind of use this nexus theory. There's enough connection between the website and the physical grocery store that we're going to have a Title III obligation. Some of the things that the court pointed out to for this nexus, Winn-Dixie had an online pharmacy management where someone could call or could go on the website, place an online pharmacy order, and then pick it up in the store. The same thing, someone could go on the website, download coupons digitally, and then use those coupons in the physical store. So as I see it, there's a connection, right? There's a nexus between what you can do online and what you can do in the physical store. And so the judge, after finding, yes, you're subject to Title III of the ADA, the judge entered what's called an injunction where he ordered compliance with certain requirements. And this is what I think a lot of folks, you know, a lot of us in the disability community were really excited because it was the first time that a judge had ordered specific compliance with a standard. So not just saying we have to be accessible, but helping us understand what that means. And so this judge had said, we need, or that Winn-Dixie needs to comply with WCAG 2.0 level AA. And then also put in things that we all like to see in settlement agreements, things like having website audits every couple of months, having web training, having compliance for third-party vendors. And so, you know, again, it was a huge win in our community. But what happened after that is something that happens frequently in these types of cases is that Winn-Dixie decided to appeal and Winn-Dixie appealed to the 11th Circuit. And this had happened back in 2018. Now, I can tell you, usually appeals take some time, right? But this one took a lot of time. So we have been waiting since this case was argued in October 2018. We have been waiting and waiting and waiting. And finally, we got a decision from the 11th Circuit. This decision came out just a couple of weeks ago on April 7th. And I got to tell you, it's not a decision that I think any of us were hoping for. What happened in this decision is that when the 11th Circuit concluded that the Winn-Dixie website was not itself a place of public accommodation. And the reason the 11th Circuit said this is that they said a public accommodation is limited to an actual physical place. Okay, so not a great finding. And then this was, I think, a huge surprise to everyone. The 11th Circuit said, you know what? And we don't like this nexus theory. Again, this nexus theory is something that we've used across the country to make sure we have accessible websites. We thought that was what the 11th Circuit had thought as well, but they said, we don't like this, the nexus theory. We expressly reject it. But that wasn't the end. The 11th Circuit then said, you know, it is still possible, even though the website itself isn't a public accommodation, even though we don't like this nexus theory, it is still possible for Winn-Dixie to still violate Title III of the ADA by having an inaccessible website. But what the 11th Circuit did is it kind of started this whole new theory. And what they said is that a website has to be a, quote, intangible barrier to accessing a physical brick and mortar store. And so what the court looked at was whether Winn-Dixie's inaccessible website was an intangible barrier, whether that totally prevented Mr. Gill from accessing the physical store. And Mr. Gill, as I mentioned, had really pointed to two things he wanted to do on the website. One was fill his prescriptions, and two was to use these digital coupons. And the court said, you know, Mr. Gill isn't able to go on the website, but he can still go into the store and he can still place his order for his prescription and he can still get it. Yeah, the court also said, well, sure, Mr. Gill can't go on the website and download these coupons, but he can still, you know, use the paper coupons and use those in a store. And so based on that, the court said there was no intangible barrier. Okay, so that's basically what the decision is. So I want to pause for a moment. And I guess I'll start with what I think we're all thinking is that, you know, this case is wrongly decided and why it has a negative impact. And, You know, I think CCB has done a lot of really great work pushing the case law forward about the importance of being able to do things privately and independently. You know, a lot of those core concepts came from the voting cases, but they've been applied in other cases as well. And this case just shows that the court did not understand or did not value the importance of independence and privacy. And there was a really strong dissenting opinion, and the dissenting opinion brought this out and said, sure, Mr. Gill is able to go into a store and announce his prescription, but he doesn't know, you know, necessarily who's around him, who can hear him. He's broadcasting his private medical information, whereas anyone who's cited who can use a website can do that privately and independently. The same thing with the coupons. You know, Mr. Gill had to rely on other people to cut these paper coupons for him and identify what they were because he didn't have access to them in a digital way. So I think from that purpose, even if we're looking at this intangible barrier perspective, it's an unfortunate decision and it's wrongly decided. That being said, there's a lot of buzz about how important this case is. And it certainly is an important case. It's certainly something that we need to try to circumvent in other circuits. But my hope is that it's going to have a limited impact. And here's why. One reason is that the 11th Circuit, of course, creates precedent or required law that other courts need to follow only in 3 states. So only in Alabama, Florida, and Georgia. And so the decision itself isn't going to have an impact for anyone in any other state. The other thing is, even for businesses that are operating in those three states, right, Alabama, Florida, and Georgia, you know, we live in a very digital world. There's very few businesses that are going to have a website that operates in Alabama that don't also have a website that operates in a different jurisdiction or a different state. And so if there's an inaccessible website, you know, a plaintiff can decide, well, I'm not going to file a lawsuit in the 11th Circuit. I'll file a lawsuit somewhere else and most likely get a much better decision. And so I actually think a lot of businesses are being counseled not to over-rely on this decision because of that sort of national scope. And then finally, the court throughout this decision really tried to minimize what Winn-Dixie's website did. Winn-Dixie's website at the time didn't sell any goods, and the court just kept saying it has limited use, it has limited functionality. And so my guess is that if there was another website that had a more robust functionality, maybe a website that sold goods directly, that the court would even find that to be an intangible barrier. So my hope is that even though I think it's a very, very frustrating and disappointing case that will have some sort of limited impact. A lot of people have been interested about what's going to happen next. So I wanted to, I definitely can't look in a crystal ball and tell you what's definitely going to happen, but I can tell you what might happen. The first thing is that the plaintiff, Mr. Gill, filed what's called a petition for rehearing en banc. So usually when you go to an appellate court, you argue your case before a panel of 3 judges. But if you think that that panel of 3 judges got it wrong, you can ask the entire panel, the entire court, which is, I think there's like 15 or so judges, to rehear and re-decide the case. Now, petitions for rehearing en banc aren't things that have to be granted. The court has, you know, can kind of decide whether or not it wants to grant that. But I think there's some reasons here that it might happen. One is there was, like I said, a dissenting judge that had a very strong dissent about how she felt this was a very, very bad decision. One is there's an argument that this case goes against prior 11th Circuit and other courts, and so causing some sort of friction within the circuit. And it's, you know, it's obviously a very, very important legal issue. And so we are still waiting to hear what's going to happen, but I guess I wouldn't be totally surprised if the court decide to rehear the case en banc. The other thing that could happen if the 7th Circuit denies the petition is that Mr. Gill can also decide to file what's called a writ of certiorari in the U.S. Supreme Court, asking the U.S. Supreme Court to hear his case. That, too, of course, is discretionary. I think, you know, those of us who aren't in the 11th Circuit are probably a bit fearful of that happening and the potential for what might happen at the Supreme Court. But that's certainly, you know, a possibility. And so, you know, it's something that I think our community's got to watch, and you know, we'll see what happens with that case. But a really important one that I wanted to make sure folks understood. Okay, I'm going to switch gears a bit. I'm going to stay on the topic of website and digital accessibility, but I'm going to switch gears a bit to employment. So remember we talked about public accommodations and what it means to be have effective communication. When we talk about employees and applicants who have digital accessibility on their mind, none of that really matters. So, and the reason why is that we're still talking about the ADA, but we're talking about a totally different section of the ADA. We're talking about Title I. And Title I, of course, prohibits employers from discriminating against qualified individuals with disabilities. And it requires employers to provide reasonable accommodations. And so, most frequently, when we look at blind applicants or blind employees who are requesting digital accessibilities as part of the application or as part of their job, the way that courts and I think the law typically analyzes it is not as whether it's something that needs to be provided based on this effective communication principle, but whether or not it could be a reasonable accommodation under the ADA. I'll say that personally, this is an area where I think we could all do a lot more work. There's very few cases about digital accessibility in the workplace, especially compared to the cases out there about Title III of the ADA. There are two cases that settled in the past year that I thought I would mention. I think they're both pretty interesting. One is a case called Murad versus Amazon. It was a case brought out of Michigan. And there we have an individual who had tried to apply for a virtual customer service position. I mean, hey, in the middle of a pandemic, when a lot of us are working from home, having a virtual community service position seems like a pretty good fit for a lot of us, right? But I'm sure this is not a story that is, foreign to anyone. The technology that this plaintiff needed to do the job was inaccessible with her voiceover. And so, because of that, she wasn't able to do the job. And Amazon ultimately said she wouldn't be able to be hired for this job. There was a settlement in this case. Amazon agreed to implement an accessible technology system that will allow blind folks to work from home as Amazon customer service representatives, and then offered this particular individual also the opportunity for to obtain a job if she applied for the job again. So, I think I don't know. It would be interesting to see what happens with Amazon. If anyone has particular experiences or knowledge, I'd be interesting to hear. But I was excited to see this case because, again, I think it's an issue that we're seeing over and over again, and there aren't a huge amount of court cases to help us to help point to show employers that they gotta comply with the law here. Another settlement I wanted to mention, and this might be one that folks might be aware of because it's a bit older. It's from February of 2019, and this is the case Bartleson versus Miami-Dade County School Board. And this case was brought by a blind counselor and clinician who had worked for a school system for 27 years, and brought a lawsuit under Title I of the ADA, saying, "Hey, the school system's websites and forms and app software, all of it's inaccessible, and I can't do my job because I need to rely on help from a sighted coworker, and because of that, I have limited promotional opportunities." And so this case also resulted in a consent decree, which is a type of settlement that's approved by the court. And there, the school system agreed to make its websites and forms and software accessible, and also gave the plaintiff some money and monetary damages. One of the things I really like about that case is it shows that, sometimes when you have a place like a school or a college or a hospital, you have an employee who has accessibility needs, it's likely that there's going to be students or customers or clients or patrons who are going to have the same needs as well. And so I like being able to kind of handle an employment case that also has a kind of a Title II or Title III angle. And I can just tell you personally, we've been getting a ton of these types of cases. We're handling some, but they're all pending. So I have to be kind of general. But the kind of the fact pattern that we're seeing over and over again is really similar to that Amazon fact pattern, where we have a lot of clients applying for jobs, certainly qualified for the job, but then they find out that the hardware or software isn't accessible, and the employer's not willing to work with them. So, again, definitely an area where we I think we all as a community need to do a lot of work. Just one thing that I think is a little tricky in the Title I world is that typically the way it works is that employees have to be the ones that request a reasonable accommodation. And so I think there's an argument that employers could make that they don't need to proactively have accessible equipment or hardware or whatever. And I think that's wrong. And I think that's something that we need to find a legal theory to challenge. But I think that is going to be what a lot of employers say in response to some of these cases. And I'm happy to chat more about employment specific questions during our time together. I'm going to just mention, let's see, I think I have about 15, 20 minutes. I'm going to mention just maybe two or three other interesting cases that have come out in the past year or so. And then I would love to chat and hear what's on your mind. So another really important it's not even a court case, but it's a decision for us all to know about is a case called Irving versus Uber. And this was a case that was brought to an arbitration, which is kind of like a private court. And it was on behalf of somebody who was blind and had a guide dog. And on 14 different occasions, had been failed to be picked up by an Uber driver, or had been picked up by the Uber driver, but had been harassed based on her disability and by her use of the guide dog. So she brought a case that ended up in arbitration and brought it under both the ADA and all of your California state law, which is great because it provides for some monetary relief. And Uber had defended itself, arguing that they're not liable because their drivers are independent contractors over whom they have very little control. Well, the arbitrator did not agree with that and said, no, Uber is really the one who failed to modify its policies to prevent discrimination and had also failed to properly train its drivers. So folks may remember there was also this nationwide settlement against or with Uber about the same issue. And so Uber also argued there's no relief for this individual because of this nationwide settlement. And the arbiter also disagreed with that and said, well, we can still give monetary damages. We can give monetary relief for this individual and awarded, you know, a pretty substantial amount, $324,000 in damages under the state law, and then $800,000 in attorney's fees. So an over, you know, $1.1 million decision against Uber. So really, really, really big news. The other thing I just wanted to, of course, remind everyone that we've seen over and over again over the past year is this kind of huge proliferation of accessible vote by mail cases. And I know y'all were part of a settlement agreement against San Mateo County about this exact issue in 2018. So I think you are ahead of your time. And in the past year, there's been just so many more of these types of cases. I mean, I would do a disservice to even try to reference all of them, but there's been ones in Pennsylvania and Virginia and New York and New Hampshire. And, you know, a lot of these have been voluntary settlements. A lot of them have been TROs or preliminary injunctions. But it's been a really, you know, when we think of what's the, so we got to think of the silver lining sometimes of this past year. And I think just the great movement for accessible vote by mail is probably one of them in my book. And then I also wanted to mention that there's been some action in the world of accessible pedestrian signals. Of course, the American Council of the Blind sued the city of New York. And in 2020, last year in October, the court had found for the plaintiff. So what happened in this case was that there was a class that was of blind and low vision New York City pedestrians, and they had sued the city for failing to provide non-visual crossing information at most intersections. And so oftentimes, we don't always win these cases on the papers or on what's called a motion for summary judgment, where we ask the court to say, even before we go to a trial, we think we win because there's no possible way you could find for the other side. And that's what ACB did here and did it successfully. And the court said, yeah, we're going to grant you summary judgment because there was a near total absence of accessible pedestrian signals, and that denies blind and low vision pedestrians meaningful access to intersections. And so what's happening in that case now is that the parties are essentially submitting remedial plans to the judge, and that's what's currently happening. But New York City is not the only place that is working on accessible pedestrian signals. There was a case also in my hometown of Chicago that the ACB of Metro Chicago filed with some individual folks. And they also sued the city of Chicago for failing to install accessible pedestrian signals. And the big news in that case is that just, I think it was last week or the week before, the U.S. Department of Justice filed what's called a motion or petition to intervene, to become intervening plaintiffs. And the idea is that DOJ wants to also help move that case forward. They also want to be a plaintiff in that case. And that petition was granted. So I think that's going to, you know, kind of bring a lot more, I think it's going to bring that case a little bit more national attention. And, you know, it always helps when we have the power of DOJ next to us advocating. So, those are the cases that I thought were the most important to point out. And I see that there's a couple of hands. So let's hear what your questions are and what your thoughts are.
Okay. Margie?
I want to ask you if you guys are doing anything about the federal government. And if not, why? They are in so many 508 violations.
Yep.
They have caused quite a number of people to become unemployed who are blind. And yep. If you file a 508 complaint, you get pushed over to 504, you get pushed over to EEO, you get pushed back and forth. Nobody knows how to handle such a case. So,
yeah. You know, it's such a good question and it's such a good point. So I do actually, I'm representing right now the NFB and an individual person in a claim against OPM and Blue Cross Blue Shield about the accessibility of OPM's healthcare programs for federal employees. I can't say much more than that because it's a pending case, but that is what one thing that we are doing. And I totally agree with you about, I mean, what one thing that's been helpful in our case and is that we didn't, at least our argument is that we, because our particular client is a retired employee, we argued that the requirement of going, you know, the exhausting your administrative remedies or whatever under 508 wasn't something we had to do. But I think there's just such a lack of law about some of those things that, you know, it's definitely an area where much more should be done. I absolutely agree.
I just want to connect with you.
Yeah,
I deal with OPM as well.
Oh, okay. Definitely. You know, we just as a caveat, you know, we are limited to representing people in Illinois, but I would love to talk and hear about your experiences and either, you know, we could team up with people in Illinois or connect with the California PNA or figure out something else, but definitely reach out. There have been a couple cases or settlements, I guess, against the federal government. There was one against Social Security Administration to improve its visitor intake processing kiosks. And then there was one against the IRS, both from last year. So one from March and one from July of 2020. So I think some work is being done, but you're absolutely right. We've got 508. It's substantively a strong law and the federal government should be the leader on these things. And so we need to hold them to account.
Sheila?
My question is, what are we going to do about bad actors? I mean, Kaiser has had settlements against it. And in my opinion, I'm not seeing much change. Mm-hmm. Their website is only quasi-accessible. Their apps are quasi-accessible. And other entities that have to do with health, such as all these COVAX sign-up sites in different counties that were horribly inaccessible. I guess the thing that bothers me is, you know, the 508's been around since 1996, and a lot of these things have come along since then. Why isn't it being followed? So my question to you, that wasn't actually the question. It was more the question to you is more, if you could send, if you had to teach recalcitrant sighted person about the web, where would you send them? Where would you tell them, you cannot talk to me again until you've actually read through this website? What would it be?
Yeah. Well, I know that Lainey Feingold has been a good friend to ACB, and I assume CCB over the years. I love her site. I think it explains things in an understandable way. I think she has a lot of practical resources, including consultants that people can talk to. I hate to say it because I think one of the problems with the ADA is that it requires us to sue, right? There's no one going around affirmatively checking things and giving people passes. And so it's a frustrating law to enforce because, you know, you're right. We have to find a case. We have to sue. We get a settlement. People violate the settlement. We have to go in and file things for breach of settlement. I mean, it's one of these processes that ends, it takes quite a long time. As a lawyer, sometimes I think the better way is not the litigation way because it takes forever. And it's more of, you know, getting people to understand why this is so important. I think a lot of that is getting people into these companies and businesses that have the power to make change who understand this stuff. I mean, it's great when companies, you know, are understanding the importance of, you know, our community and making sure that we have access to things. I don't know. That's not a great answer. But I guess I hear you on the frustration part because I think it is definitely a problem, but I do like Lainey's website. Especially I'm a huge fan of like when I'm trying to resolve a case, looking at other good solutions. And one way I do that is by looking at settlements that other organizations have entered into. And Lainey has a lot of good samples out there that, you know, businesses could look at to see, okay, how do I do this? It's more than just saying, I'm going to make my website, you know, WCAG 2.1 compliant. It has things like, let's have user testing. Let's have manual and, you know, and automatic testing. Let's have a policy. Let's do audits, you know, let's have a training program, but like all the things that we really need to put into place to make sure that this stuff sticks.
Okay, Jeff.
Thank you, Rachel, for being here. Great presentation. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as I think many people in this audience know, even during the Obama administration, where we had such high hopes, you know, DOJ refused to do anything about, you know, adopting regulations. And of course, there was not even any chance at all of that happening during the Trump administration. So, and I also know there are those out there who are trying to push for legislative, you know, for a federal enactment that would solve the problem, although I suspect we won't get that done in today's Congress. But do you think that there'll be increased pressure and any possibility of the Biden administration finally getting their act together in terms of website accessibility regulations?
So maybe I'm just an optimist, but I do. And I'm really hopeful that it will happen. And, you know, maybe a decision like Winn-Dixie is going to help push the administration to see, you know, like, let's enough of this nonsense. We've been arguing about this and coming up with ridiculous legal theories for 20 years. This shouldn't be rocket science, right? This shouldn't be such a controversial thing. Like, the ADA is supposed to make sure that we have equality and we have equal opportunity and access. And how can we have that if the internet's not covered by the ADA? I mean, the internet is the internet, you know? So I don't know. I'm not part of the administration. I can't say for sure, but I am optimistic and I am hopeful. And I think we've got a good chance. I think there's some good people in the administration too, that get these issues. What do you think?
I'm hopeful, but not, I'm cynical.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Keith.
And I think most folks know this, but you know, the regulation process went on for years. You know, there was an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, the first step that was announced like in 2010. and that was on hold until 2017 when the regulations were withdrawn from the Trump administration. So it was 7 years of sitting there. So I don't blame you for your skepticism at that point.
Okay, your next question is from Keith.
Hi, Rachel. This is Keith Kobala. This is a very good presentation so far.
Hi, Keith. Great.
I am actually studying to become an ADA coordinator.
Oh, it's a hard job.
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, it's hard. It's challenging, but it looks like it's good based on everything I've heard so far.
Yeah.
There are a lot of issues that we need to work on as far as 504, 508. And I'm learning a lot now. I'm learning more now based on what I heard about the public accommodation thing, like websites. So I'll be happy to network with anybody, with you or anybody this weekend about on what else I'll be happy to network and get more information.
Well, yeah, it's great to meet you. So if anyone wants to follow up with me, my email is Rachel W. It's RACHELW at equipforequality.org. And definitely shoot me an email. There's, you know, I do trainings regularly for this group of ADA coordinators. And I got to say, I mean, ADA coordinators have a hard job, and it is such an important job. And it's a job that can really make such significant changes for how organizations handle ADA issues. So more of us in the disability community that can be trained and learn how to do that job, you know, I just think that's one way we can really effectuate some meaningful change. So props to you for doing that. And to the extent you're not already linked up with your regional ADA center, they have some great programs and trainings for ADA coordinators too. So definitely something to check out.
So your email again is Rachel?
It's Rachel W. at equipforequality. So EQUIP and then for equality.
688, last three. You may unmute.
Hi, my name is Bernice, and I'm one of the seven plaintiffs that filed against the Social Security Administration in 2009 for a couple of issues.
Uh-huh.
They're not following the rules that were passed, and I wish that we could do something to deal with that. And secondly, as a retired federal employee, they refuse to give me any information about services, medical services, you know, from the different companies in accessible format, because I'm not employed. They can only give it to employed federal employees.
What? Are you part of their health system?
Yes, when I was working for Social Security, I switched when I moved to Washington D.C. to the GEHA plan. They had seven uh-huh. national plans, and I have kept that ever since. I still have it.
Huh. Yeah, shoot me an email. I'll keep you posted on our case too, because would probably apply to you.
Okay.
Okay. 844. Last three, you may unmute.
And this will be probably last question.
Rachel, I want to thank you very much for an extremely clear presentation. I'm wondering about something which was actually sort of indirectly suggested by the previous question. What is the durability of our settlement agreements? I'm particularly worried that in the public sector, they're expiring, and for various reasons, they're not retaining the momentum or the follow-up that would be necessary in some cases. So since so much of our advances have been based upon the wonderful work bringing about these settlement agreements, what can we do to preserve them?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of settlement agreements have an expiration date. And if there's a violation during the settlement agreement, you can always file a lawsuit for breach of the settlement agreement. If the settlement agreement is called a consent decree, that's when the court has essentially blessed the agreement. You can go actually back into the original court and say, hey, you know, things aren't working, and try to get relief that way. If the settlement agreement has expired, then unfortunately, in a lot of cases, the only thing you can do is file a new case or do some new advocacy. But I think in that case, especially, you know, for folks who have remedies under state law to get some money, I mean, you're showing some real bad faith. Like if they knew and an entity knew that they had to do something and they had an agreement to do it, and then, you know, years later, they're still not doing it. I mean, it's hard under, you know, it's hard to show, it's hard to get money under certain parts of the ADA, but I think there's a good factor there and a good argument that, you know, it really shows how, I don't know about intentional or it shows like some real bad acting on behalf of the covered entity. But it also, you know, it also shows the limits of what the law can do. I mean, I think as a lawyer, there's a lot we can do and we've got a lot of tools in our toolbox, but there's limitations of what the law does too. And I think what you've pointed out is, you know, one example of a limitation.
All right.
It's all, we're that was actually the last one.
Okay.
If anyone else has a burning question that I didn't get to, you can feel free to send me an email or give me a call. I'd be happy to talk.
Awesome. And thank you so much, Rachel. We really appreciate such a timely presentation. And thank you to Jeff Tom for connecting Rachel with us. It's really appreciated. And you have a happy Friday. Feel free to stick around and listen in if you'd like.
Okay. I actually need to run and pick up my kids from school. It's 4:00 here. So I'm going to go do that. But it was such a pleasure talking with everyone and have a wonderful weekend and a great convention.
Oh, thank you so much, Rachel. All right. Everybody give a virtual round of applause to Rachel. All right.